Reshmi Dutta-Flanders is the latest guest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Reshmi is Honorary Research Fellow in English Language and Linguistics at the University of Kent, and she talks about growing up in Calcutta, coming to London in 1989. She compares her experiences of previously studying literature in India and how she was able to acquire various research skills. She talks about the influence of aspirational parents. Her father was a survivor of the partition. She talks about her own experience of an arranged marriage. We find out that her mother has written a book at the age of 80. Reshmi talks about a need to prove something to herself, while she has often felt a sense of dissatisfaction and never really having felt a sense of belonging. She talks about why she needs to push herself forward, the degree to which education could be seen as an enjoyable pursuit, how it might be possible to enjoy what one is doing in the moment without worrying unduly about the future. We find out how once she has finished one project, Reshmi has an urge to start something new, why she's not comfortable recycling old ground. We talk about Reshmi's childhood influences, 1970s ABBA songs, and how they were sources of fantasy in her conservative upbringing. We find out why she found her university lecturers as her gurus, why coming to university gave her an identity which she didn't have at the time. And we find out about her experience of teaching in Category B and C prisons, where her students were often institutionalised prisoners. And we find out how she wrote a book recently on crime fiction and the different apprehensions she has had of working in male and female prison environments. And then we find out whether it is possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences, and how Reshmi didn't have goals so much as a value system predicated on the importance of peace, security and stability. So join me, Chris Deasy, for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My guest this week is Reshmi Dutta-Flanders. Well, I am delighted to have Reshmi Dutta-Flanders with me, and delightful also, of course, that you brought your new book in, which
That's
was wonderful, and I'm sure we'll talk about that in a minute. But we've known each other for a few years, and perhaps you just want to say a little bit about yourself and what you do here at the University of Kent.
Before I start that, I am proud that I have known you, and I'm privileged that I have known you through my book. Whilst writing my book, so yes, I'll go with the first question. Where I was born? I was
absolutely
born in India.
Yeah.
I was born in India, and I came here to do my undergraduate studies at King's College London, and started with Old English. It's a language on its own, and soon realized that this is something I will never ever. It'll take a lifetime to pick up. Studying the language and then studying Beowulf and all the literature that was written in Old English. And so I said, no, I want to be a little bit faster with my education and not start learning a language altogether before I get into studying what I want to study. So, but I realized at that time that language was something which intrigued me. So yes, I came to this country to do my undergraduate studies in King's College London, and this was second undergraduate studies. I have already done one in India.
Was that in a different subject area?
It was in English literature. Yeah, that's how I came to know about Old English, Beowulf and Chaucer, you know, the Pilgrims on the Way. And so I wanted to say, okay, I wanted to learn that English language. You know, I've always Old English, I mean. I don't want to just read the translation. I want to see what it is actually, and the hieroglyphics and all that.
Did you find them very different experiences?
When I came here, I think what I felt was I was put in the system almost on the deep end with undergraduates who were quite conversant with Old English. They have studied Old English at schools somehow. So they were, you know, reciting the poems in Old English whilst I was in an awe listening to how they sound. And the system, you know, just to go about knowing how the education system works, it was totally different. How was it different? The exam system is different because we have end of year exams. You don't have that. You have assessment throughout the year. And the ground they had covered as literature from school after doing undergraduate studies in India, I felt I hadn't covered anything like that. And I will never, ever, as a literature student, be able to anyway cover what they have already covered from school. So I soon realized how far I can go with, you know, doing undergraduate studies in Old English literature. But in a way, after doing 1 year and taking one exam, I realized that I would love to do anything with language, English language. So,
but that model actually is an interesting one, because certainly my experience as an undergraduate was that it was predominantly assessment by exam at the end of the final year of the degree. So all those essays that you wrote, those wonderful referencing systems that you came up with, you know, learning the difference between the Harvard and the, you know, the MLA, in-text notes, all of those conventions, how to go to the library and undertake lots of research and assemble it all together, kind of counted very little when you're sitting in an exam.
Yes.
The clock on the wall says that, you know, you've got 45 minutes left to answer that first question.
Yes.
And it's about, okay, what can I remember? What can I recall from my lectures or from my reading? And put it down without being able to show off the referencing and the quotations. And it felt like, a bit like a memory test sometimes.
Yes, exactly, exactly. So I think it's interesting you put it that, you know, you learn so much from not taking, besides taking the end of year exam, because all these other skills like footnote, referencing, using the library, researching, which I am told in across the pond, it's taught, it's more of a taught process, whereas here you almost find your way. You know, you are not taught how to do the referencing. You're not taught how to go about. You almost let your intuitions lead you to where you go. Only I realize that now, but at the time I thought I was put in the deep end, and I was very critical of the system. But yes, I came out learning and take it for granted those skills like referencing and learning about referencing, learning about research, finding new questions, new areas whilst researching. You know, you go in with one question and then you find out, oh, there are other 10 questions I've come across through the literature review. You take those for granted because you're more targeting that I've got to finish this all this within this time. How can I do that? Nobody told me what to expect. You know, those sorts of stuff. But now that you pointed out, yeah, I took those for granted, but yes, it makes me more richer, and it is not no more a memory game.
Yeah, and one of the challenges, I think, and actually one of the great things about the university system today, is that the best of both worlds can be encompassed, that students can show off what they know in a three-hour exam at the end of the year, but also they're rewarded for showing what they can do when they've got several weeks to assemble an assignment. And I think those skills make it easier for a lot of students just to be able to display a wider range of talents, which an exam never did, and that was just the system in those days, so you just had to play it. I remember actually even in one case with me, I remember thinking during the exam, when it was a bit too late to think about strategy, why didn't I write a mock paper? You know, if the exam was 3 hours, why didn't I pace myself? Because what I always did in an exam was go way over. So if I had three questions, it was a 3 hour exam, it would have, and they were equally weighted, it would have made sense to spend an hour on each question. And because I was enjoying writing the first answer, I'm thinking, oh, this is going well. I went way over the time, leaving myself about 20 minutes for the last question, which carried the equal number of marks. So again, it's live and learn.
Yes, exactly. But because we were, you know, almost indoctrinated into that sort of assessment system end of the year, so I was quite happy with that. But with these library-based exams, you take away the question, 7 days you get to work in the library and come back with your answer, with your assignment, or you get, you know, that was quite new. And I enjoyed it, I must say, you know, and it prepared me. It made me a more rounded person. And that's why I can see why studying in India was a bit boring and, you know, very, very predictable.
But in terms of then what happened in your upbringing, so what about your family? What did they do?
Yeah, they were very aspirational. My father was the survivor of the partition. This is in late 50s. He was growing up in late 50s, a young youth. He survived the partition, saw his family, you know, get killed, and was left with his elder brother, who was 10 years older to him, and he was the youngest. In between, everybody died, not because of the partition, because in those days, you know, children didn't live very long, you know, so only my uncle and my father survived out of the five, I think, of them. And basically, my uncle, who was 10 years older to my father, brought him up. He was his parent. So my father was brought up in a village school, but I don't know where he learned this, his English. He became an engineer and got his degree in Wolverhampton. So
he made the journey here before you?
Oh, long before me, yes. Before I was born, before he was married. So what happened was, there's a story behind that. Now, this is in 1957 I'm talking about. India has just it's new India in the sense post-freedom. Post-independence. And he applied for scholarship to come here. And because all his families were not with him anymore, so he had to get a village friend to be his witness. So he gave him a cycle saying, you be my witness, I have to sign. Once you get through the scholarships, you know, before the money is given to you, no family member, his brother can't be a witness. So he got this. So I remember mom telling me that story. So he came here in 1950s, did his degree in Wolverhampton in engineering. He's a mechanical engineer. And he went back. He was very patriotic. But he did regret, I must say, he said that I should have, after I finished he was 5 years in this country, in Birmingham, and I should have gone a couple of years to USA, because USA was quite advanced engineering-wise, and then I should have come back. And in the meantime, mum was born in Burma, and she had to also, lock, stock, barrel, had to leave Burma. Because of, again, they got their independence, so they had to come to India. So that's another story. And mom grew up in Calcutta, where I grew up as well. And she did her, she never was satisfied being a housewife. She got married to my father. She turned down my father, though it was arranged. She turned down my father in the first arranged meeting. My grandfather said, "Oh, you are an assistant engineer. You know, you have to become a proper engineer before you can get married to my daughter. So, or have my daughter as your wife." So my father went away and came back. So that's a lovely love story, I must say.
So who did the turning down then?
My grandfather. And mum was obviously, yes, mum definitely accepted my dad, because when he came around, she got married to him. So obviously she had eyes on him. But yes, my grandfather turned down, the turning down, saying, "You are an assistant engineer." So that's the story. Anyway, mum was never happy. She had three, I'm the first, and she had three kids. She went on to have three kids. And they had kids away from, you know, away from Calcutta, but she wanted to come back to Calcutta to be closer to her family. And dad had only, you know, he was kind of orphaned with only one brother who was far away. But what was interesting is my mom was never happy being a housewife. And she's 80 now, and she's just written a book in religious studies.
Good heavens.
Yeah, historical aspects of challenging. If you have heard about Ramkrishna Dev, he's one of an avatar of, they say it's Lord Krishna, and Ramkrishna has in his teachings has and Vivekananda, the philosopher of India, in his teachings come up with certain aspects of religious practices in India which he challenges. He was very, very especially for women, because at the time child marriage and those, and women sati pratha, which is a woman, if she gets widow, becomes a widow, she has to die with on the husband's fire, you know, those sorts of stuff at that time. This is, I'm talking about that era. And he was quite advanced about these, Ramkrishna Dev, the avatar. And he has, in his teachings about women, he gives a lot of priority on that. So mom is doing some, you know, it's a research, religious-based research book. She has just finished, and Ramakrishna Mission is the mission who is going to publish her book.
Was that something that she always wanted to do?
She always had it in mind, but she was like, okay, it's there in my mind, I will do it one day. Now, we lost our dad because of cancer. Now it comes to in 1988, my dad died. So she had all that time, and children had left by that time. In another next 5 years, we all left home. I am in this country, my brother is in Canada, my sister is in Australia, working in USA, in two countries. So I can't say that my mom had children to bring up. So she had a lot of time to, but she never ever took it. It's almost like now she has time. In the last 3 years, she has been writing this book. But she was always a writer. She wrote in magazines, poems, and short stories. She always was a writer.
Yeah, my grandfather always had a book within him, and it was really about a love story, meeting my grandmother. He wanted to write his autobiography, but he finally succeeded when he was in his 80s after my grandmother died. So he spent the last decade of his life from his mid-80s to his mid-90s writing, and it turned out to be several volumes. I mean, never published, but maybe one day it ought to be. I think that would be a fitting legacy. But well done to your mum. That's brilliant.
I think so,
you need to do it at that point. In other words, there's nothing worse, I guess, than always having an ambition to do something and never quite seeing it through. And also, as one of her daughters, I guess, for you, and obviously as somebody who's published yourself, you must be sort of really proud that actually she did manage to see that through, because we all have these dreams sometimes of things we might like to do, and how frustrating it is when they're never accomplished. But she did achieve it.
Yes, and this is her achievement in the from the publication point of view. But I think I got that a little bit of a streak, because I was never happy being a mum and just being married. My ex-husband being a plastic surgeon, you know, talking about carpets and curtains and having those coffee mornings. My mum did a PhD sitting at home and, you know, looking after three kids. My father was always very ill with ulcerative colitis, a bleeding colon. So she had quite a handful, you know, bringing up. And in India, it's not easy being my father being the sole bread earner. She never went out to earn a living. So, and she did a PhD just sitting at home after she sent us off to school. She started writing her, going to the library, and lo and behold, 4 years on, she finished her PhD. And then a long gap, and now a book. So, yes.
It sounds like that was a real inspiration for you, because you obviously managed to, and you know, obviously you're still having your journey, shall we say. But I think we were talking just before we started recording, and you were saying that you always had this urge to write, but not always to stay within a particular comfort zone. Would that be right?
Exactly.
You did your PhD, but then you wanted to do something else. You wanted to publish in a different area rather than just recycle the same sort of material.
Yes, exactly, because I always felt that I didn't know enough. And I don't know why. I kept proving myself, okay, I'll do another undergraduate in this country. I'll do another MA. I'll do a PhD. But nothing satisfied me or gave me the confidence that I know enough, and that's enough, and I can now put it into practice. So always this dissatisfaction that I don't know enough, kind of maybe I have inherited from my mom, that she was not satisfied being just a housewife and just having a social life, secured married life. Maybe that is what I've inherited. And it still is with me. I still feel I don't know enough, almost at the point of I feel like I'm an imposter. I shouldn't be here. But it just, one thing led to the other through that deep-seated dissatisfaction. And that's why I don't like to talk about what I've already done until I'm teaching my students and therefore it's referenced. But I would not like, you know, go and talk about it and make that an issue about talking. I want to talk about something new, something different. Whatever I've done and I've put it in print is there. Why is this dissatisfaction? Why is this sense of I don't know enough? I just don't know. What will prove me that I know enough? Or do I want to prove myself that I know enough? I really don't know.
Well, it's admirable because it shows that life is a constant quest, that there's a lack of complacency, and that's admirable. I think I see exactly where you're coming from. In my case, having achieved, say, the PhD, there was a part of me that thought, okay, that's obviously the inverted commas right thing to do. So I found it difficult then to come out of that comfort zone, because it was more a case of saying, well, in doing this, it's safe territory to teach, it's safe territory to talk about, to get a few publications out of it. And I think it's taken me perhaps a lot longer than it should have done to sort of think, well, that's what I did 20 years ago. I don't have to be defined by that monograph, shall we say, forever, that it's okay to branch out into other areas. I think my mistake was thinking that if I got a PhD, as I did in the area of religion and film, that therefore my whole career was going to be working around those sort of areas, almost in the sense that that was my qualification, therefore to do anything else would be inappropriate, because I wasn't grounded in those areas. Whereas, of course, it's okay to learn on the job. You know, the skill from doing a PhD can then be applied to other areas. Mm. While you might still be teaching your PhD area, but it's okay to branch out. And I've started to do that. For me, the work on Christmas and the present project on nostalgia is quite different to what I was doing 25 years ago. But that sense of dissatisfaction is really interesting, as is what you were just saying about, you used the word imposter, and you're not the first interviewee in this podcast series to refer to that sense of feeling that you don't entirely belong, and that can actually be the most amazing driver for producing very good quality work and having lots of aspiration and lots of ambition. And, you know, these are all laudable qualities. But have you always carried that with you?
If I use this phrase, the sense of belonging, I never felt that I had that sense of belonging. And this quest to belong, I want to go home. Where is this home? Home through knowledge, home through experience, home through where it's my natural self. I never found that. And I'm still finding it. I'm looking for it. And I don't want to be pigeonholed just because I did a linguistic stylistics, master's in linguistic stylistics. I don't want to be pigeonholed into that if other things will come in the way where I can explore with this linguistic stylistics and it will take me to another direction. I won't be afraid, because the word fear is always there, but not in a fear where I will not venture out. It almost, that word fear almost pushes me to venture out. I don't know how, you know, that negative feeling of that fear has almost pushed me out, that I have to go out and get over this feeling. Why am I feeling afraid? What is making me afraid? What is making me feel that I don't belong here? You know, why? And that's kind of the driver. And so coming back to my mom, is a dissatisfaction, I'm not satisfied, can be a little bit, maybe if I were a little bit more content with what I am doing, maybe I would have spared my health. but I think it is me.
I remember teaching a student a long time ago, and she was the last student to leave the lecture theatre. And I took the opportunity to congratulate her on a first-class essay that she'd written. And, of course, I thought she was going to say, yes, I'm really delighted with the mark, and, you know, maybe not. Maybe I didn't expect her to start jumping on the table, but I thought she was going to be very happy. And what happened was a real life lesson, because she burst into tears. And I thought, but you've just written a really good essay. You must be really proud of that mark. Why are you upset? And she told me that the health implications from staying up all night, taking tablets, not sleeping, being constantly anxious and on edge, and considering also this was only her second year, she thought that it would be very hard to sustain that level of commitment and dedication. And she was worried that she was not going, you know, that she peaked, that essay was something that she almost, you know, her health wouldn't permit her to replicate. In the end, something clicked into place, or at least maybe there was medical intervention, I don't know, but she was a lot calmer after that, but she produced good work. She did get a first at the end of it. But I always remember that just because somebody is producing good work or somebody's well published, doesn't mean to say that therefore everything is wonderful. In fact, it's the lack of confidence, and in some cases it is that fear, that almost that tiger within, I'm not sure, yes. Maybe there are other animals that, you know, more suitable analogies, but which do... certainly the devil within, yes. You know, the inner demon, is what sometimes is the real motivator, rather than the sort of, yes, I'm so marvellous, I can produce anything, no. Because I have those skills. No, I mean, I never feel that sense of complacency. Mm. And even when I'm in a classroom situation, for me, the worst thing that can sometimes happen is if you're talking about your research and everyone is either switched off or they don't think that you are explaining yourself very well. Yeah, for me, I have to sort of go an extra mile because this area is so personal to me. So I think we all have those drivers.
Yes, because sometimes you have to understand that what is making you all enthused about your idea, that idea has to also be universal so that you can engage your idea with others. And that's a fear in itself. And that's an experience in itself, which you want to, whilst you want to experience, you also want to successfully come out of it and not, you know, get students say, well, what did I get out of it? And that is what is always at the back of my mind. So when people say, oh, try and enjoy what you're doing, and I used to question myself, how can you enjoy studying? How can you enjoy a career which is to do with education and study? It's only now I understand the word, what they mean by enjoying. It's enjoying not the failure, what the failure will be. Before you have had failure, you're thinking of failure. But so it's enjoying the process of what you're doing in the moment. And don't worry about the outcome. Because the moment you do that, there is a saying in Sanskrit, karmanne badhikaraste ma phaleshu kadachana, meaning just focus on the work you are doing as best you can do. Because that will, if it is not best, then somebody said the failure is your success, in all honesty. Mm-hmm. Because a successful person doesn't have anything more to learn from it because it's successful. But in a way, that is what the Sanskrit is saying. Just focus on your work. The success will come with the quality which you don't know at the time when you're working. And that's what I am now, and it has helped me to work with my health and work together, because work is, education is so intense that it is sometimes very difficult for me not to be intense. And I'll bring my husband in, and he gets very uptight because he sees me as a very intense person, and that's my work is defining my personality. And now I'm thinking, if I start thinking of what I am doing rather than where it will take and what how I'm doing it, then I'm enjoying the process, and it'll give me opportunity, because I'm calm, for others to show, okay, can you think about that or do that? And therefore it becomes an enjoyable process rather than something of a performance.
And the end goal can also change, because
exactly,
it's the same with a research project. You start off thinking that there will be this outcome and that outcome, but along the way you think, oh, through doing the research, it's taking me in a slightly different direction.
That's the enjoyment.
Yeah. Rather than having it all prescribed for you, you can actually manipulate. You have some autonomy over the shape that the project is going in.
And that knowing too much where it will go can be, in a way, an anxiety, rather than not knowing a little bit to let it take you where it will go, can be quite surprisingly rewarding. And that's what happened with my book, because I did not realize that its outcome will be like this. I just wrote it, you know, what I know, as best I know, as best I could. And not knowing that how the outcome will be, because I really did not know. I had no clue about this journey. I know how to do a PhD. I know how to supervise, you know, another PhD. I've done dissertations, but PhD. But really, this is something I did not know. And I still feel I did not know. I have to know a lot more. It has almost opened up another Pandora's box. And I'm like that little child. I want to have more of that candy.
Yeah. And also sometimes you'll get a PhD. It happened to me at the Viva. One of the first questions I was asked was, where are you thinking of publishing this? And I think in your case, you're saying you've got the PhD, but you want to do something different. Mm. And you want that to be the hallmark of what is to come, rather than just, you know, recycling old ground. So I think that, again, it's part of that whole sense of needing to prove something really just to yourself.
I think my journey with the day I came to this country in 1989, and today is 2018, nothing has been prescribed. I thought, you know, where I thought I would go this way, but it turned out that I had to take another route. And I never like anything unfinished. If I start something, it almost makes me feel very uptight if I haven't finished it. And if I haven't finished it, then I have to go somewhere and finish it. If staying here, I haven't finished it, I have to go. And that is what the finishing line is far more important, that I have to finish to a project like my PhD. I started actually in Nottingham, and I had to come to Kent to finish it without going into details. And that was what was, I will not question why it did not happen, why it not happened, because the more I question, the more I'll become uptight and I'll start becoming, but let me, this is a journey. At the time, I don't know why it happened like that. But now looking back, I'm grateful that it happened. I met somebody like my supervisor, Tony Becks. I met so many good people here in Kent, which I wouldn't have in Nottingham. You know, it opened a whole new avenue of linguistic stylistics, which I wouldn't have over there. I was only doing functional linguistics, which was very, you know, small. So I've stopped questioning. But it comes with pain or sacrifices. Not pain, sacrifices.
Mm. And, compromises. And it sounds like along the way as well, there have been some disciplinary changes that you've got. Yes. You've moved outside of your comfort zone.
Yes, exactly, yeah. I had to. I had no choice. If I have to finish this, what I've started.
And was your mum's PhD in the same area as the book that she's just published?
No, funnily.
So again.
No, far away. Her PhD is totally different from where she was actually a history student, literature history, and she's now into religious studies. History and religious studies, historical perspective of religious studies.
Clearly a family trait then, this urge to constantly
I've never thought
learn.
About it, yeah. Mum was never mine.
And transgress and cross boundaries.
Yeah.
And which also means something that I did struggle to do a bit more, which is to move outside of your comfort zone. Mm. And in your case and your mum's case, it clearly paid off.
At the time, we just went with our intuitions and what was in offer. And it just unfolded. Mm. It just unfolded. That's all I can say, because that's why I tell my students, you know, once you've done your PhD, or not my students, my colleagues, sit with it. See what, you know, enjoy teaching it, or just sit with it, because that's what I did. I got my PhD in 2003 and I wrote this book in 2014, 1 year. So, you know, all that time, I didn't publish anything out of my PhD. So, and this book is nothing with PhD. It's completely different. It's actually the experience of 7 years of teaching linguistic stylistics, to be honest.
Mm. Oh, and sometimes teaching can be the most incredible groundwork for a book, because you can tune into the sensibilities of the students. You can see why some areas are a hit and some others don't quite go down as well with the students. You can be informed and challenged by the students and their questions. And I've often acknowledged them in my own books to say, you know, it was because the students were questioning something that I had taken for granted that made me want to push those boundaries. And I'm in debt to them accordingly.
Exactly. Because teaching 7 years, I my understanding of the discipline became more clear, concise and more confident. Because when you're doing your own PhD, you're also learning at the same time what you're producing. So your confidence of that discipline, to work with that discipline, in that discipline, once you're teaching and once you're challenged, it becomes more grounded and more solid. I wouldn't have been able to do what I've done soon after my PhD. Mm. No, I'm grateful that life did not allow me quickly, because I've seen a lot of people have written published soon after their PhD. And I'm grateful that life forced me through teaching in the prisons before I could get into linguistics, teaching into linguistics, and then again another 7 years of teaching into linguistics, that it took me this long to write this book. And I'm grateful.
I want to talk in a moment about your work in prisons. But just before I do, just going back to India, in terms of things like earliest memories or what you remember doing as a child, I'm interested in how that informed the path that you went on to take. You know, what were the things before you entered academia, before you became a student, what was it that you remember from your childhood as defining you, the things that you enjoy doing, the things that maybe even to this day you still practice?
In one word, I would say that from at the vantage point at what point I'm now here, looking back in my childhood, my first school days were in a boarding school. And I remember the playing ground. I don't remember the classrooms. And I remember it was a very British colonial building with very teak stairs. You know, that's all I remember of the boarding school. Childhood memories, honestly, I don't have anything beyond that. I don't know why. So I can't say I brought anything from my childhood into my adulthood. I still remember that playing ground. I still remember playing with children, very dry ground. That's all I have of my childhood memory.
What about things like musical influences or interests?
Yes. I love ABBA. I was introduced to ABBA by my cousins. And I loved, if I can say something I brought over, is Lucy's Experience. This American soap, I think it's a TV series,
Lucille Ball, yes, of course.
A real awkward housewife, doing everything, wrong. But I think I don't do everything wrong, but I'm one big awkward, shy, saying things as it comes, and then I realize I shouldn't have said that, or I'm too guarded. And that is kind of, I think, that childhood experience of watching Lucille Ball and how she managed to, rectify her big problems of a big comedian. Whilst I'm not a comedian, I'm quite a serious person. I come out as quite serious. But those were, and ABBA's life journey through their songs, their lyrics are beautiful, and I can associate. So those things I think I have.
It's interesting what you say about ABBA, because I was trying to explain to somebody the other day who didn't know the Mamma Mia films, how you could make a film based on the lyrics of ABBA songs, or the plot of the film is informed by those lyrics. And in your case, that's something obviously that you came to well before Mamma Mia the musical or the first film.
Yes, in India. This was in India in the 70s when ABBA was here all the way, and this is transnational journey, and I was absolutely smitten by ABBA, smitten by them. They are not very, as a band and as a group, they are not very good looking, I can't say, but their lyrics were, I really fantasized. And you've got one question which relates to the, what sort of music did you listen at the university? I listened to Bollywood music. I always fantasized, because I had a very conservative upbringing, and having a boyfriend was something we couldn't think about. And I fantasized in my head looking at these Bollywood films, boys and girls dancing with the songs. And ABBA comes along with all these lovely tunes of how a woman is going to conquer the world, money, 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 and all that stuff. It was like two worlds going on in my head. Whilst I wanted to be a woman, I wanted to experience myself as a woman, go through the life of being a mother and having a husband and a man in my life, which I'm not allowed. But at the same time, ABBA and their lovely lyrics. These are the memories, I must say, I cherish. Nostalgic. That's nostalgic, but that it's not there anymore. Life's experience and reality has definitely taken a different direction.
But it shows what escapism can do, because it sounds like you were, as you say, smitten by those songs. But at the same time, it didn't completely dovetail with your own experience in terms of the opportunities that may have been there. I assume you were talking about, arranged marriages, for example, that the idea of meeting the person of your dreams, it may not have been embedded in the culture in which you grew up in the way that it was in the in those ABBA songs. However, you saw a basic teaching, which is that love really does rule the world, and sort of the idea, you know, that is the name of the game. But you know, I think that there is something really powerful in that, and it happened growing up for me, not always with the lyrics of songs, but certainly the identity formation that came with saying, you know, this has struck a chord for whatever reason, but it needed to be validated in the playground by those friends. It wasn't the isolated listening, it was the sharing of that in a world, of course, before social media. But it almost, if I liked something, I still do it with film, which is probably why I put film reviews up on Facebook. In seeing something, I want to share it with somebody. Otherwise, it feels somewhat wasted. It feels almost selfish otherwise, you know, to watch something and just sort of not do anything with it. It's probably good research skills as well, because, you know, you read something and you say, well, there might be a book out, you know, I might get a chapter out of this or whatever. So, no, what a fascinating journey. But so in 1989, you came to the UK. And was that to do your second degree?
Yes, second degree, yeah.
Yeah. And where did you do that?
At King's College. I started at King's College, but I didn't finish it. Yeah. So, and in the process, I got married and became truly a housewife. And this 5 years, I was going around with my husband because doctors at the time were training and they don't do training in one hospital. So I got to travel around the country in UK. And when I had my daughter in 1991, I said, no, I won't be traveling with you anymore. If you have to go for your career, you go ahead. I'll be now grounded in Nottingham. My sister was visiting. We just had lost our dad in 1988. So my sister was visiting, and she wasn't married at the time. And she was visiting, and she said, Didi, you are sitting here feeling miserable. I know your daughter is very young. Why don't you, I can see a university close by, why don't you just put in your application? And that's it. I came into academia and started my master's in English language. The course was English language in literary studies. So language and literature came together.
Yeah, absolutely perfect. Because that's exactly what you've been following.
Absolutely,
since.
Yes. Yeah. Linguistics, discourse analysis, functional linguistics, whatever you call it, it is language and literature coming together. Fact and fiction.
Were there particular teachers who inspired you when you were at university?
Not in India.
But in the UK?
Yes.
So you had gurus in the UK but not in India. That's interesting. Why was that? Was it because of the prescribed form of teaching?
I think so, yes. Now, looking back from my experience, at the time, they just didn't... They are just a stepping stone, yeah. But I will always feel that today what I am is because of who are my senior lecturers, but really they are my gurus. I learned what the discipline is through the way they have given us through their books, through their works. That's how I know I've come to learn the discipline. And it started from Nottingham. I wasn't inspired. Maybe that's the reason why I gave up in King's College London. Again, that was another very prescribed course. I can't explain, you know, but definitely language and literature when I was introduced to that. In fact, when I was interviewed by Dr. Herman, who went on to become my external examiner for my PhD, in stylistics and discourse analysis, she worked with two disciplines. She said, why should I give you a place at this course? You are a mother with a kid, and are you just doing this to pass time, or are you going to take this ahead with your career? At the time, I could not answer that. And I said, this is a very valid question. Am I taking it very seriously? But now, I met her last year with the book, and she was surprised that she had asked that question. She said, I'm a feminist. I couldn't have asked you that question. I said, yes, you did, Dr. Herman, but I'm here with my book now, and these are my inspirations, you know. So, yes, it's the few people I really will always have in my mind and will follow their footsteps are starting with Nottingham, in Belfast, and one of them is in Glasgow University.
And it sounds as though, because you were raising a daughter at the time, that being at university was probably sometimes, maybe not a struggle, but it was certainly about balancing lots of different priorities. And I'm guessing that while you were studying, you were also having to do things like school runs and making sure that you were home for your daughter, and perhaps not enjoying campus experience in the way that some of your peers were.
Funnily enough, I bought the campus to my house. So all my friends, when we were in Nottingham, the 13 of us, we were from different parts of the world. We always, over the weekend, they came around, and we ate together. I had to cook. So I said, okay, why not? You guys come. And as I said, my husband, ex-husband, was already working in different places at the time. So I was with my daughter. So yes, I had campus every weekend at home. The campus was at my home. So I did not miss out on that. What I missed out, the being in, you know, my daughter was always, I had to think about my daughter all the time. So I started taking her to campus dues when she started walking. So I never ever, you know, lost an opportunity to what, because I got married when I was a mere child of 19, so very young to get married, and then 5 years on I had her. So I always experienced university properly with my daughter. What I would suggest is, I think the university, coming to university, gave me an identity which I didn't have at the time. And whilst I was trying to establish that identity, I started to learn about myself. And that is what I am grateful for. And it all started from Nottingham.
Yeah. I think that the way sometimes you can turn what some people might construe as something debilitating to your advantage, you know, that yes, you were raising a child, yes, that you may not have had the inverted commas freedom that some of the other students had, but it sounds like that was your situation and you embraced it and you didn't feel or make yourself feel that you were missing out. If anything, it sounds as though it probably pushed you harder.
Yes.
And you just found,
yes,
you found what you needed to do. You just may have found the route there different to your peers, but not necessarily,
yes,
one which might have been,
yes,
construed as a negative.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I it is negative. Maybe that's why I'm still dissatisfied. But no, I haven't missed out. If you talk specifically, I haven't missed out on campus life. No
yeah,
way.
You were talking earlier about the work you've done in prisons,
yes,
teaching. I'd love to hear about that, because that sounds as though you found yourself in a situation where, rather than just going through the motions, for example, of teaching, you were teaching people who weren't necessarily going to be pliant or compliant listeners. And I'm guessing that as well as transforming those prisoners, you yourself probably were changed in that process, because you must have learned so much about yourself. I mean, I can't even imagine what it would be like to go into a prison every day and teaching people who were, in some cases, you were telling me earlier, were in for their second offence, and they were
more
only
than
sort of 18
yes,
years old.
It's life of prison, actually. Yeah, Rena, they're growing up in the prison institution. They're institutionalized, absolutely. In fact, they go out, they last there for a few months because they can't cope with real life, and they come back. So it's almost they're institutionalized. I don't know whether I've taught them anything, but definitely they have taught me. The prison, teaching in prison, has taught me a lot. It's almost like today what I am doing with my research in the area I'm researching, the area I'm working with, it's almost like this was in 2003, it was almost preparing me for today. So, and I will be going back and working possibly with prison, not in the prison, but associated with prison research. So if I didn't have that hands-on experience at the time, today I wouldn't have been able to understand what I want to do with my research or where the research I wanted to go to.
Because your work is in crime fiction.
Yes, exactly. But fiction, I want the fiction to go into fact and bring the two together, fact and fiction together. And if I didn't have the hands-on experience or the real experience in the teaching whilst teaching in the prison.
How did you end up in the prison sector?
That's an interesting story. Survival for the survival, really. When I finished PhD, I didn't have the opportunity to become an AAL as people do generally now here. You know, you carry on teaching what you were doing whilst you're doing your PhD, which we didn't have at the time. And the department was already closing. In fact, my supervisor, Tony Bex, who already had retired, had to come back for my viva. So that was a phase. So what do I do from here? And by this time, unfortunately, I was already a single mom. What do I do? Somebody who was, my daughter was at the time close playing, you know, as a school friend. Her mother said that you have finished your PhD. You need to, they are recruiting teachers, or would-be teachers for training. I said, okay, I'll go. So I went to Christchurch. And I enroll for teachers for the teachers training, but most of them come whilst they are already teaching. So and I did not have any placement. So they said, "Would you be interested to teach in the prisons?" I think looking back, ignorance was bliss. I didn't know what I was signing up to. I said, "Yes, if that gives me teachers training, some teaching hours, and I'm most happy." But as I said, my mantra is what I start, and if I start something, I will not. I will see the end, and the end was to get that teacher's training, post compulsory. I went to teach before I went into prison. I went to teach for 2 months in a middle school at Sheppey. 11 years old. God, it was a nightmare. I lasted 1 month. And the head teacher said, "I'm sorry, you're not going to be able to finish this. That's a GTTR, you know. I don't think you're right for this sector. What we will do is, I know that you're a single mom and you need a job. What I'll do, I'll give you 1 month's notice. So I'll pay you 2 months' salary, but we won't carry on with this." And then I took on this prison teaching placement. And 8 years, yes, 2003 to 2008, I was there. My first prison was a youth prison in Dover, 18 to 21-year-olds. From there, I went to adult prison, B and C category prison in Maidstone, and then East Sutton Park, the open prison for women. That's the worst place. I would prefer to work with men prison than women prison. And then I came to Canterbury, closer to home, and I was there for 5 years, teaching basic skills, key skills, whatever came, you know, in my way.
You mentioned that being at a women's prison was a worse experience than teaching at a male prison. Why was that? What was it about that particular experience that was so striking?
They are more set in their ways, and women, maybe it's a gender issue, they are very competitive, whereas I think when it comes to male, our positions are quite defined and they don't challenge that definition, but a woman will challenge it, and because they are set in their ways, the kind of thing that, who are you to tell me what to do? And they have more challenging personalities. It could be that because I was a female teacher, so I was, and that is the only female company men had in the prison, so I had it easy. Whereas with women, that's not the case. So they always challenged me a lot more. And not growing up in the system as a child in this country, so there were certain things there were cues which I could not pick up, and that kind of left me a little bit in the open to get it wrong.
To feel vulnerable.
Yeah, not necessarily vulnerable, but get it wrong maybe, you know. So I kind of approached them maybe in a slightly more, in a different way than they would expect. Mm. So I found that very challenging. I worked there only for a few months. Mm.
But the PhD, you didn't tell the prisoners that you had the PhD. Yeah. Do you think that would have affected what your standard? Do you think that they would have had a different perception of you?
If I had told them when I started working in the prisons, then yes. I did at the time, I was just guided by my intuition. I could not explain like this as I can now. But at the time, my intuition said that, no, I should not divulge that I'm a doctorate and I'm working here. So I kept that. I went to lengths not to, you know, even in the application form, I did not mention that I was a doctorate. So, yes, it did come out quite late, 5-6 years into working in the prisons by that time. And I remember the governor, the education governor, when he came to know that I was a doctorate, was very surprised that what was I doing here.
As in you were overqualified?
Yeah, well, that was an inference, but he didn't say. He was surprised. First, I heard he double-checking with my colleague that, is she a doctorate? And then I can't quite remember how he came to know I was a doctorate. And then later on, it was my head education department manager we were very close, Susan Mesto Playfair, her name is. And she kind of divulged, do you know that Reshmi is a doctorate? And Robert, his name is, he was very surprised. And he said, is she? And I said, yes. And then, and this was before I joined the group. I think by that time I had established, because my manager also was quite supportive, was really very admirable. She admired me for what I did and how I was making this as a career. I really thought prison will become my career, but my health did not allow me, so I had to give up.
But it sounds like you learned an awful lot from that experience. I don't know whether you've carried any of that for good or for bad with you in terms of classroom dynamics. There's also just sort of life skills in terms of, you know, knowing how to watch sort of what you say, but also to make sure that you can manage a class which is perhaps not very receptive in a way that, you know, isn't going to be the case in a university environment, to being taught. I'm guessing that for many of those there, education was something that they saw as an anathema.
It's a very good question. I think I'm confident about the sector now, about classroom management. When I started teaching at the university, the management was completely different from what I did at the prisons. So when I was training to be a teacher, I still feel that I did that certificate, but it really did not prepare me for the real life. I really had to go through the experience to prepare myself for what the job demanded of me. I knew what to expect, but that's about it. But how to go about managing everything, all I can say is now, prison, when people talk about prison, prisoners, probation officers, police, law, it doesn't faze me. That's all I can say. Whether it gave me classroom management, no, I had to really learn all over again from my students here at the university what they expect from me. Yes. So it has been a journey. Yeah.
Absolutely, but a very unique journey, I think, compared to what many other people certainly in this profession have, because I've never even taught school children, and a lot of my students have PGCEs or want to do PGCEs, and I admire them, because in many ways there may be a love of subject, but it's about communicating that in an environment where you've got a lot of, you know, 11 or 12 year olds who perhaps have got other things on their minds, and the privilege of teaching at university is that, you know, that the students are only there because they want to be there, and if they're not there, well, you know, there may be penalties that we impose in student support, obviously. You know, there are disciplinary procedures in place, but at the end of the day, if they don't come in, then it might actually be sometimes better for everybody else. Because if somebody was, you know, hypothetically going to be a disruptive presence, well, perhaps better that they're not in the classroom. Mm. So I've never had to deal with anything on the sort of scale that you must have done. But just a few final questions. Mm. In terms of some of the more sort of, you know, philosophical ways of looking about this, do you think it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences? It sounds as though along the way you must have had some quite incredible experiences that has made you, you know, you look back and think, what a life, what a career that you've had or still having.
I think, you know, coming into academia was really by chance. It's the dissatisfaction, it's an identity crisis. I didn't want to just be a mother. So all these things brought me here to where I am. So I'm grateful that all the experiences that at the time I was going through, wasn't enjoying it, but it was almost a destiny preparing me for where I am today and where I will go further. So I, on hindsight, I'm grateful for my experiences, and I look at it fondly that it prepared me through a lot of hardship. Mm. At the time, you know, I wanted to throw the towel maybe with the bathwater. Mm. But glad that I kept persevered, and nostalgically I'm grateful for the experiences.
And if you were to go back to the childhood self, maybe the childhood self that was listening to ABBA and who knew what was around the corner, would you be surprised at the path that your life has taken? Or indeed, conversely, do you feel maybe that you've fulfilled the dreams that you had when you were young?
I wouldn't say I have a dream. My only dream is to get over this dissatisfaction of or feeling an imposter or feeling that I don't know. This fear I don't know. I'm going to embarrass myself and everybody else. This is the only, you know, kind of drive I have. I have no goals as such, because the moment I have goals, I find that I'm challenged with it. So I don't have any goals. All I need, standing here today, maybe 10 years down the line, I'll come back to you and say, there are three things I want, which I was speaking at the conference in Birmingham, peace, security, and stability. That's all I will go for. And how I will achieve that, I don't want to be in a state of anxiety through my fear because I'm constantly looking for knowledge and experience and more confidence. No, I want really peace within myself, stability and security. Mm.
So it's not so much a particular career or particular job, so much as a vision that you've kept to. You've kept that in mind all the way through from the beginning about the sort of things that you want to achieve, which is different from saying, I want this particular job or I want that particular salary. But it sounds as though what you're doing now is in keeping with who you were, your value system as a child.
Yes, that if I'm secure and stable, then I can do a lot of things. And that was never, ever given to me somehow. You know, it was given, or it was the way it was given to me, or it is being given to me. I have not been satisfied. People would say, "Oh, you have such a state. You know, you're married. You're well. Your husband is well off. Why are you not happy? Your child has done well. You know, you have done your duties. Why are you not happy? Or you've written a book. Why are you not happy?" So, well, there is stability, then one could say, you know, and security, one could say, but still. Mm. I'm still looking for that peace, stability and security. All I can say, that's my dream.
Yeah, and what a driver as well. But my last question, would you consider yourself a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Forward.
Absolutely forward?
Absolutely forward.
Yeah.
I wouldn't, I'm in a total contrast with my own spouse, who's always talking about his childhood, and I don't talk about my childhood. No. Forward.
Yeah. Fascinating in terms of what this nostalgia project is doing for me, in terms of looking back in order to look forward sometimes. Or I think you have, maybe you're being a bit not harsh on yourself, but I think that it's clear that the values and the goals that you had when you were young are very much sort of have been carried forward in all that you've done since in your life. But it sounds as though you're always looking for the next role to play, the next project to do, the next book to write. And although you talk about fear, it sounds as though also there's a lot that you can be rightly proud of, and that there is a continuum that just listening to you, it sounds very clearly that you're on.
What you say as proud of, to be proud of, is just a milestone I've covered to go to the next milestone, because I can't get to the next milestone until I have covered this milestone. So I don't know why I'm pleased that I could do the projects which I have completed. I think I'll be proud of myself when I feel that I have. Yes, I'm still not. I still feel I haven't completed my completed. It's not that I have more opportunity or anything like that. I still feel I haven't completed the knowledge I want to have from this life, which is I'm born, you know, for something. What it is, I don't know. It's a big mystery. That's why I'm working with crime fiction, crime.
Yeah, well, it's come full circle. But Reshmi, thank you. That was a wonderful conversation. Thank you very much.
And thank you for having me. That was brilliant. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm really, really pleased. Thank you.